Chapter 9. Darkening Skies, 1979 through 1983. Lucas was having serious problems with his sequel. One of his actors, arguably the breakout star of the first film, had made it clear he was not coming back for the second film without a significant increase in salary. The script was weak. "It's one of those stories that shouldn't have a sequel, really," said Gary Kurtz, and Lucas, despite his promises to the contrary, couldn't stop meddling in the production. When he wasn't hovering over his hand-picked director's every move, Lucas simply went around him, directing several sequences himself and taking over in the editing room. The sequel was more American Graffiti, and Lucas had practically been badgered into doing it. "I'm not ashamed I made it," Lucas would say later, but that didn't mean he was happy about it. Trying to cash in on Lucas's name in the midst of the Star Wars tsunami, Universal had re-released American Graffiti in May 1978 to considerable success. "Even sweeter the second time around," swooned Gary Arnold in the Washington Post. And Ned Tannen had not too subtly reminded Lucas that he still owed Universal at least one more film. To Tannen, a sequel to American Graffiti seemed natural, but Lucas, who was already developing the Star Wars sequel, balked at the idea of going back to that particular well again. Shrewdly, Tannen threatened to produce the sequel without Lucas's involvement, the very idea of which he knew Lucas would find unacceptable. Reluctantly, Lucas gave in. This was exactly why he had insisted on all sequel rights in his Star Wars contract, and agreed to deliver a follow-up to his first big hit. It was probably doomed from the start. Lucas had already boxed himself in with the ending of American Graffiti, in which end cards had revealed the fates of each of the four main characters. But he developed a rough story outline anyway, and began wooing his cast from the first film, landing most without ever having to show them a story outline or script. Richard Dreyfuss, however, who had played Kurt, had gone on to a star-making turn in Jaws in 1975, followed by an Oscar-winning performance in The Goodbye Girl in 1977. And with the parsimonious budget provided by Universal, Lucas never stood a chance of landing him. "Not enough money," Dreyfuss huffed to the Los Angeles Times. "They offered me 1/10 my usual salary, and I said no. I still get along with Lucas. He just won't be telling the story of Kurt Henderson." Lucas turned over the task of finding a screenwriter to another old USC friend, Howard Kazanjian, whom Lucas had recruited to serve as the line producer for More American Graffiti, a throwaway title indicative of Lucas's already flagging interest in the project. Kazanjian brought in BWL Bill Norton, a classmate of Gloria Katz's from UCLA, who met most of the criteria Lucas was looking for in his scriptwriter. He was a Californian, close to Lucas's age, and with one bomb, the 1972 drug drama Cisco Pike, on his short list of credits. He was also looking for an opportunity to write and direct again. "George didn't want to direct it himself," said Kurtz, "but he wanted someone he could control. Norton was his man." Norton was ferried up to Parkhouse to discuss the storylines Lucas had plotted out for his four main characters, some of which George had already worked out in detail, remembered Norton, while others needed fixing. Lucas had devised four parallel stories taking place over a series of New Year's Eves, following John Milner, Steve and Laurie, Terry the Toad, and, with Dreyfuss out of the picture, Toad's accidental girlfriend from the first movie, the earnest Debbie Dunham. Lucas also envisioned shooting each character's story in four distinct styles, with Debbie's hippie adventure filmed in a psychedelic split-screen style, for example, while Toad's exploits in Vietnam would be shot in black and white on scratchy 16mm film, looking very much the way Lucas had envisioned shooting Apocalypse Now. Lucas stressed to Norton, in fact, that he expected him to work fast, getting the film written, shot, edited, and released before mid-August 1979, when Coppola's version of Apocalypse Now was due in theaters. When John Milius learned what Lucas was up to, he could only shake his head in disbelief. He wants to steal Francis's thunder, you know. Norton wrote quickly, though Lucas had Kazanjian looking over his shoulder, discouraging Norton from creating new characters or straying too far from Lucas's story. The script wasn't all that wonderful, said Kurtz, who was likely glad to be free of the project, but the script hardly mattered to Caleb Deschanel, another USC friend whom Lucas had selected as his director of photography. Shooting in multiple formats, Deschanel said later, was a crazy idea, but we had a great deal of fun. It was really a continuation of the atmosphere at USC. Lucas gave Norton a mere 44 days to complete principal photography, still an eternity when compared with American Graffiti's 28-day shoot back in 1972. Filming began at a California drag strip, the stands crammed with extras lured in by Lucas's promise of free Star Wars toys. Lucas showed up on the first day and vowed to leave Norton alone, but found he couldn't keep his hands off. He would direct nearly all of the Vietnam sequences himself, shooting several military helicopters near Stockton, California, then take over the editing process, further marginalizing Norton. Lucas knew he had run roughshod over his director, and admitted later that their conflicting approaches to the film hadn't worked. My whole idea for a style for more American Graffiti was ultimately unsuccessful, I guess, Lucas admitted. Bill's a more conservative kind of storyteller, and I think I forced him to do things that in his heart he wasn't comfortable with. The artistic conflict was apparent on screen as well. On its release in August 1979, More American Graffiti bombed with both audiences and critics, though it was Norton who took most of the heat for Lucas's decisions regarding the look of the film. The Washington Post called it a blithe mockery of the original, suffering from a terminal case of the cutes. Meanwhile, in a New York Times review, Janet Maslin slammed the film as grotesquely misconceived and, in a bit of criticism that must have stung Lucas to the core, compared its Vietnam sequences unfavorably to Coppola's Apocalypse Now. Kazanjian was perplexed by the criticism, but Lucas merely shrugged. There are things I don't like, there are things I do like, he said enigmatically. But he had to be concerned. Regardless of his distaste for the project, his first attempt at a sequel had tanked badly. Now he was in the middle of making another sequel, with every dollar he'd earned at stake. And the experience with More American Graffiti had spooked him. Everything I own, everything I ever earned is wrapped up in Empire Strikes Back, he said nervously. We don't really know whether Empire is going to turn out to be another More American Graffiti. If it should be a flop, I will lose everything. And things weren't going well with the sequel. Screenwriter Lawrence Kasdan had been reworking the Empire Strikes Back script until almost the last moment before filming was to begin, doing his best to color inside the lines provided by Lucas and the late Lee Brackett. Lucas had made it clear that out of respect for Brackett, he intended to give her a story credit, and that was fine with Kasdan, who, as he pounded the script into shape, sometimes debated whether he wanted his own name in the credits. There were sections in the script, recalled Kasdan, which, when I read them, made me say to myself, I can't believe that George wrote this scene. It's terrible. So was the weather. As director Irvin Kershner began filming in Finse, Norway, in March 1979, a blizzard that was massive even by Norwegian standards battered the production, with whiteout conditions making it impossible to see more than a few feet. Improvising, Kershner simply pointed a camera out the door of his hotel room to film Hamill staggering around in the snow. Lucas arrived at Elstree in late March to find the massive soundstage he and Kurtz had fronted with their own money, which would always be called the Star Wars stage, still under construction. Its insides exposed to the spring rains, and a stage 4 that had been ravaged by fire. Furthermore, the dollar was growing increasingly weak against the British pound, pushing costs upward with each passing day. Lucas's budget, initially set at $18 million, was now inching toward $22 million. By July, it would slide up to $25 million. It was money Lucas didn't have. Lucas swore repeatedly that he was done directing. I think I can be more effective as an executive producer, he insisted. But he would never be entirely comfortable delegating the directing duties to someone else. It's very difficult to look over another director's shoulder, observed Kurtz. And yet any time Lucas was on the set, he would stand watching, arms folded, mouth tight, itching to look through the eyepiece. I don't have a strong feeling of wishing it were being done another way, he declared, then backtracked immediately. Well, perhaps once in a while, he continued. But I much prefer that somebody else do the work. Kasdan marveled at Lucas's ability to get his own way, trying to guide everyone into exactly what he wanted, and being very good and funny and charming in the Georgian manner. Or as Kirshner noted diplomatically, I've caught him looking through the camera only twice so far. As filming went on, things would not change. Away from Elstree, Lucas had taken it upon himself to personally oversee as much of the special effects work as possible at ILM. I have control over the special effects, so I feel confident that we're not going to be in trouble there, he told one journalist. The only problem I have now is the speed of the production. Lucas had tangled with Dykstra during the making of Star Wars over the glacial pace of creating the necessary technology. He now found that the painstakingly constructed equipment used for Star Wars already needed updating to handle the more sophisticated effects for Empire. Some shots, like the pursuit of the Millennium Falcon through an asteroid field, required the compositing of more than 200 pieces of film, which in turn required ILM to build a new optical printer. Lucas's confidence in the effects was one thing. Controlling the costs was another. The special effects, like everything else associated with Empire, it seemed, were burning through his money faster than expected. As spring turned to summer, the situation went from bad to worse. Kirshner, who had been hired for his finesse with actors, was lingering longer and longer over each scene, rehearsing and rewriting dialogue and encouraging the actors to give their input on dialogue or staging. Most of the time, his devotion to the actors paid off. A long discussion with Ford and Fisher ended with Ford's Han Solo responding to Leia's declaration of love with the memorable ad-lib, "I know." But the deliberate pace was slowing production and angering Lucas. The few times Kurtz stepped between Lucas and his director, he tended to take Kirshner's side, and to Lucas's further annoyance, even Marcia defended Kirshner's vision for the film. "Marcia and I agreed a lot," said Kirshner. "We thought the Star Wars movies could hold more character and more complexity. George thought they should be simple in another way. It was a serious philosophical difference. For me, it wasn't an emotional issue. I felt it was his movie and I was working for him." Another domino tumbled over ominously in June when Alan Ladd announced his resignation after a loud argument with Fox executives, leaving Lucas without his strongest advocate at the prickly and unpredictable studio. Ladd's departure, in fact, had been triggered largely by his devotion to Lucas, which, argued studio bean counters, had resulted in the lopsided contract for Empire that tilted largely in Lucas's favor. Ladd wouldn't be leaving the studio until winter, but the announcement sent Kurtz scrambling to ensure that all their contracts were signed and deals were in place. Then, on June 5th, John Barry, Lucas's talented Oscar-winning set designer, turned second unit director, collapsed at Elstree and died hours later of meningitis at age 43. The death sent shockwaves through the company. Kurtz assumed second unit responsibilities while Lucas flew to London to try to get a handle on the fraying production. At nearly the same moment, the Bank of America, nervously eyeing the ballooning budget with a weekly payroll of close to $1 million, suddenly threatened to pull Lucas's loan and shut down the operation. Lucas was furious and laid the blame for the budget busting squarely at the feet of Gary Kurtz, who, in Lucas's opinion, had coddled Kirshner in his leisurely pace and failed to keep production on a tight leash. "George got really concerned about how long we were taking," Kurtz said flatly, "and he banged me for the cost overruns on Empire." As Lucasfilm's lawyers begged for patience, Lucas scrounged for funding, steering $525,000 from Black Falcon over to Chapter 2 and stretched what little cash he had left by moving to a biweekly pay schedule. Anything to avoid going to Fox on bended knee and asking for the money he needed to finish the movie. Lucas would never give them that satisfaction. All the money I had made from Star Wars was committed to this film, plus more, but I didn't want to go to Fox and give them the movie because I'd have to give all the rights back, said Lucas. I had to keep the picture going, somehow get people to work without pay. Hope to hell that whatever they asked for didn't involve me having to go back and renegotiate big time with Fox. As always with Lucas, it was a question of control. I wanted my independence so badly. Eventually, he agreed to give a few points to Fox in order to have the studio guarantee a new loan from the First National Bank of Boston, a compromise both parties found agreeable. I think Fox was just as concerned as we were that the movie get finished, said Lucas. Still, Lucasfilm remained the ultimate guarantor of the loan. If Empire didn't turn a profit, Lucasfilm was very likely done. With so much at stake, Lucas felt he had no other option but to hover over Kirshner for the remainder of the film. I had to be there every day, and I had to be helping Kirshner, Lucas said later, which developed into a lot of work. When asked directly whether he could get the job done more quickly than Kirshner, Lucas responded matter-of-factly, "I think I could." He also inserted himself into the editing process, weaving a second edit from Paul Hirsch's first cut of the film nearly as quickly as Hirsch could assemble it. Even with Lucas more directly involved, there were still some problems that were beyond his control. Several reels of film were ruined in the development process, while others came in with the picture too muddy to use, forcing Lucas to abandon a number of sequences in the interests of time. The most important scenes remaining to be filmed were those involving Yoda, whose development Lucas had put largely in the hands of Muppet creator Jim Henson, in collaboration with Stuart Freeborn and the Wizards at ILM. Lucas liked Henson immensely. Both were fiercely independent, presiding over their own scrappy companies, free of Hollywood interference, and each was a self-proclaimed gadget freak, committed to developing the technology needed to bring their visions vibrantly to life on screen. Yoda, then, was an important project for both. Lucas needed a lifelike puppet and a talented puppeteer to perform him, while Henson was eager to apply the lessons learned from ILM, mostly about using smaller, remote-controlled mechanisms to move puppet eyes and ears and cheeks, to the film he then had in development, The Dark Crystal. Yet while Henson oversaw much of Yoda's construction, to Lucas's surprise, he had chosen not to operate the puppet himself, recommending instead that the character be put in the hands of his longtime associate, Frank Oz. The versatile Oz, who performed such characters as The Muppet Show's Miss Piggy and Fozzie Bear, was admired for his ability to create characters nearly at will. He considered himself an actor, not just a puppeteer, and over the past few months, had immersed himself in the character of Yoda, devising his own backstory for the character, giving the diminutive Jedi Master both gravitas and a subtle sense of humor, as well as a distinctive way of speaking. Lucas did have some doubts about giving such a pivotal role to a rubber puppet, no matter how talented the puppeteer. "That was a real leap," said Lucas, "because if that puppet had not worked, the whole film would have been down the tubes." He needn't have worried. Not only was Yoda carefully built, with small motors and rotors to open his eyes, wiggle his ears, and pull back his cheeks, but also he was brilliantly performed by Oz, with a team of two and sometimes three other puppeteers in support. The moment filming began with Oz and Yoda in early August, it was clear the character was going to work spectacularly well. Oz was so convincing in his performance, in fact, that Kirshner often found himself offering directions straight to Yoda, rather than addressing his comments to Oz, crouched uncomfortably out of sight, just below the set. Even Lucas could get caught up in the moment, sitting cross-legged in Yoda's home, completely wrapped up in conversation with the puppet, even with Oz in plain sight. With Yoda literally in good hands, Lucas applied himself personally to wooing the film's other Jedi Master, as well as the last holdout from his original cast. Over lunch, Lucas successfully lured Sir Alec Guinness back with the promise of 1/3 of a point for less than a day's work. With the final piece of the cast puzzle locked into place, Lucas headed back to San Rafael at the end of August to oversee ILM, warily leaving things in London to Kirshner, but not under the supervision of Gary Kurtz. With the shoot now more than 50 days over schedule, the budget still creeping upward, and the bank nervous, Lucas decided he'd had enough of Kurtz and his indulgence of Kirschner and put Howard Kazanjian, his producer from More American Graffiti, in charge instead. "I had to get the film made," Lucas said without a whiff of sentimentality, "and that was all I really cared about at that point." Under the eye of Kazanjian, Kirschner completed principal photography on The Empire Strikes Back on September 24, 1979. Lucas was relieved. Now he could really put his hands on the film by working with editor Paul Hirsch, first out of Parkhouse and then in a rented space at 321 San Anselmo Avenue. Lucas was dissatisfied with Hirsch's first complete cut and reassembled the film to give it a quicker pace, much closer to his own preferred style. But the result was a disaster. Scenes went by too fast, making it impossible to invest in any storyline, and Lucas squabbled with Kirschner, Hirsch, and Kurtz, all of whom eventually prevailed on him to revert to the slower, more deliberate pace of Hirsch's edit. In the meantime, the reliable Ben Burtt would continue to edit in sound effects, and Lucas still had several key voices to dub in as well. James Earl Jones would be brought in again to perform Vader's voice, including the delivery of a key piece of dialogue, "No, I am your father," that only Hamill, Kirschner, and a few others had known about during filming. Obscured by the Vader mask, Dave Prowse had delivered the line as, "Obi-Wan killed your father," and wouldn't know the real plot twist until he saw the movie in the theater. For his part, as Jones recorded Vader's dialogue in the winter of 1980, he remained convinced that Vader was lying. The other important voice belonged to Yoda. Even as he watched Oz perform the character on the Elstree soundstage, Lucas still wasn't certain he wanted Oz speaking as the Jedi Master. "George didn't want my voice," said Oz matter-of-factly. "I gave him the voice tape. He said, no thank you." But as Lucas sat through one voice audition after another, he came to appreciate that, in terms of puppetry, the person who is actually acting the role is really into it, and that Oz, like Anthony Daniels with the voice of C-3PO, had been the natural choice all along. Most days, however, Lucas spent at Kerner, watching Dennis Muren, Richard Edlund, and the ILM team slowly but steadily assemble the special effects. To make the projected May 1980 release of Empire, the effects had to be completed no later than March. Apart from utilizing the same motion control technology pioneered in Star Wars, ILM would also use old-school stop-motion effects for the armored, snow-walking AT-ATs, as well as for the agile Tauntauns used by riders in the film's opening scenes. As the number of needed effects inched higher and higher, keeping track of each shot became more than the film librarians could handle with pencil and paper. For the first time, then, Lucas and his team invested in a new tool to help them log and locate every single frame of film. Sitting on a table at ILM was a brand new Apple computer. Lucas, always a gadget freak, was intrigued by the filmmaking possibilities presented by computers. The computer-controlled camera at ILM and the desktop Apple filing system were all very well, but Lucas envisioned a day when computers would make film entirely obsolete. "Anybody who's worked with film realizes what a stupid 19th-century idea it is," argued Lucas. And that was because, with traditional film, every single element in a shot, actors, special effects, lightsaber glows, laser beams, had to be assembled individually, then put together on the optical compositor, a process that was a time-consuming headache, created considerable room for error, and often left the film scratched or faded. For someone who coveted control then, especially someone who built his movies in the editing process, digital filmmaking, in which all the elements could be manipulated directly on a computer screen with no image degradation, seemed ideal. The only real problem was that Lucas had no idea how it would work. The technology he envisioned didn't exist yet, not even on paper. In short, it was a perfect sort of research and development project to take on at Skywalker Ranch. Not that there were actually any facilities yet. At the moment, the ranch was still mostly a series of drawings pinned to the walls at Parkhouse, though Lucas was slowly beginning to hire vice presidents and division directors he could install in offices the moment they were built. The computer division was one of his first priorities, and Lucas was determined to hire only the smartest, most visionary computer designers, programmers, and engineers available. His first employee was a brilliant computer scientist and physicist named Ed Catmull, then serving as the director of the New York Institute of Technology, housed in a converted chauffeur's quarters and garage on Long Island. He and Lucas hit it off almost immediately, and Catmull was quickly installed on the top floor of a building Lucas was renting in San Anselmo, with an office adjoining Marsh's. Over the next year, Catmull would bring in his former colleagues at NYIT one by one, slyly poaching his old partner Alvy Ray Smith and others to ensure the Lucasfilm computer division had the smartest staff available, just like Lucas wanted. For Catmull and his staff, all science fiction geeks blown away by Star Wars, working for Lucas was a dream job. In all of Hollywood, George was the only person to actually invest in filmmaking technology in a serious way, said Catmull. The big studios were too risk-averse, but George understood the value of technical change. He was the one that provided the support when nobody else did. Lucas put them to work developing a digital filmmaking workshop, complete with a digital editing system, a digital audio system, and a digital printer, where the images would be combined and manipulated. Catmull, who admired Walt Disney nearly as much as he admired Albert Einstein, was hoping to persuade Lucas to let him devote some time to computer animation as well. Lucas, however, considered that scope creep. He wanted Catmull developing tools to make digital movies, not wasting his time on what Lucas regarded as high-tech cartoons. Catmull did his best to follow orders, though he continued to hire the kind of staff he wanted, even when that sometimes meant doing it on the sly. When Catmull hired a young former Disney animator named John Lasseter, he finagled the approval of Lucasfilm executives by giving Lasseter the title Interface Designer. The computer division would work diligently, though slowly, over the next few years to create the digital tools Lucas envisioned. And while Catmull and his team may have differed with Lucas over the ultimate objectives for the new equipment, they did share his knack for thinking up snappy names for their project. Over dinner one evening, one designer had suggested they name their new digital compositing computer the Picture Maker. Alvy Ray Smith suggested they come up with something just a bit cooler, perhaps referencing the laser the computer used for most of its scanning, and proposed the name Pixar. After a bit more discussion, they decided to tweak the word slightly, giving it a name they all liked just a bit better: Pixar. The Empire Strikes Back opened on Wednesday, May 21, 1980, in 126 theaters, and broke attendance records in 125 of them. No other studio opened a movie against it. Once again, fans waited in line, many camping out overnight, some standing in pouring rain, while countless parents wrote notes excusing their kids from school, then stood in line alongside them. That same week, Time magazine put Darth Vader on its cover and hailed the movie as a better film than Star Wars. The following week, President Carter invited the visiting Vice Premier of China, Geng Biao, to watch the movie with him and the First Family at the White House. Geng Biao was on the edge of his seat all the way through the movie, reported Carter. Fortunately, he did not ask me for any of the weapons he saw in the movie. Reviews were generally positive. Lucas had won over critics at Time and the Los Angeles Times. And, in a real coup, even the highly opinionated Pauline Kael at The New Yorker proclaimed, "There is no sense that this ebullient youthful saga is running thin in imagination." But many reviewers were put off by the film's intentionally darker, more grown-up tone. Janet Maslin argued in The New York Times that the present film is just as polished and technically proficient as Star Wars, but seldom as light-hearted and seldom as much fun. Meanwhile, Maslin's colleague Vincent Canby found it positively bland, dismissing it as a big, expensive, time-consuming, essentially mechanical operation, and adding, "It looks like a movie that was directed at a distance." Lucas had also confused critics and fans by adding before the opening crawl that audiences were about to see Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back. Those paying attention pointed out that Lucas had tipped his hand on a re-release of Star Wars, with a new header on the crawl reading Episode 4, A New Hope. From here on, Lucas would always claim that he had taken his enormous first draft of Star Wars, divided it into thirds, then decided to film the middle third first, with A New Hope as the fourth installment of a 9-part saga. Kurtz could only shake his head. "That's not true," he said later. "There were a lot of little bits and pieces that were reasonably good ideas and that ended up being in the final draft of Star Wars, but there wasn't enough material to do other movies." Lucas, however, would maintain he'd had a galaxy-spanning epic mythology in mind all along, though he would sometimes waffle on whether he had intended it to be 6 parts or 9. Regardless, at least one critic bristled at Lucas's nerve in teasing fans with the promise of even more Star Wars. George Lucas has revealed that the two pictures are actually parts 4 and 5 of a 9-part saga, huffed Judith Martin in the Washington Post, as if audiences will someday receive the total the way devotees now go to Seattle for a week of immersion in Wagner's complete Ring cycle, a concept she dismissed as nonsense. In the weeks leading up to the release of The Empire Strikes Back, Lucas remained uncertain whether he had a hit on his hands. "I think it stands just as much chance of being a hit as not being one," he said. "I guess I'm the biggest pessimist around here. After all, I said the very same thing about the first one." He was also concerned about the math. After prints, advertising, and distribution costs, Empire was going to have to make $57 million just for Lucas to break even. And to build Skywalker Ranch into the kind of complex he envisioned, Empire was going to have to do much more than merely break even. He needn't have worried. Within 5 weeks, the film had made $64 million. By September, it would surpass $160 million. Empire would close out 1980 as the year's biggest movie, and by the end of its first run, it would gross nearly $210 million, making it the third most successful movie of all time, trailing only Star Wars and Jaws. Lucasfilm would pocket more than $100 million in profits. Lucas had literally bet the ranch, Skywalker Ranch, on Empire, and won. With Empire behind them, Marcia may have hoped that she and her husband could at last have a little downtime together. "My wife likes to have vacations," Lucas told Starlog magazine. "She doesn't like not to be able to go anywhere, year in and year out. She'd like to be able to say, look, let's take off for 2 or 3 weeks and just cool out. It always comes down to saying to her, next week, just let me get past this thing. By the time you get past this thing, there's always something else, and you can't leave." This time, the something else was Raiders of the Lost Ark. Once again, Marcia would have to wait. Lucas had actually shopped Raiders all over Hollywood for the better part of a year, sending Kasdan's first draft around to Universal, Warner's, Orion, and Paramount, along with a list of terms. In a deal reminiscent of the one he had cut with Fox for Empire, Lucas was offering to finance Raiders himself to the tune of $20 million, and would then permit a studio to distribute the completed film in exchange for a percentage of the profits. Warner's, still trying to make amends to Lucas after his bitter experience with the studio on THX 1138, expressed interest early but then dragged their feet for so long that they were outmaneuvered by Paramount and its aggressive, forward-thinking president, Michael Eisner. "George came over to my house," recalled Eisner, "and he said, let's make the best deal they've ever made in Hollywood." On November 7, 1979, Paramount announced an agreement with Lucasfilm and the Raiders Company, in which the studio had given Lucas nearly everything he'd asked for. The film's profits would be split 60-40 in favor of the studio, until the film broke even, at which point profits would be shared equally. Not a bad deal, but Warner executives warned Paramount that giving a filmmaker what he wanted meant the end of the film industry, a criticism that had already cost Ladd his job at Fox. But Eisner wasn't a bit worried. "If we got shafted on this arrangement, we would like to be shafted 2 or 3 times a year in this way," he said. Even as Kasdan continued with his script through 1979 and into 1980, there had been a moment of clarity from Lucas regarding the name of their main character. Spielberg continued to insist he didn't like the name Indiana Smith, which put him in mind of the 1966 Steve McQueen Western Nevada Smith. For Lucas, who simply wanted the main character to have a quintessentially American name, it was no problem to change the name to Indiana Jones. The name was easy. Casting, however, proved more difficult. As he usually did, Lucas had thrown a wide net, bringing in lots of actors and actresses for the lead roles of Indy and Marion. Christopher Guest, Deborah Winger, David Hasselhoff, Jane Seymour, Sam Elliott, Karen Allen. And then videotaping various combinations to see if sparks flew. He was impressed with Tom Selleck, who had done mostly commercials and small television parts, but he had recently landed the lead role in the CBS television series Magnum P.I. The network, however, sensing their actor's rising star, locked Selleck into his contract, making him unavailable. Lucas admitted to Spielberg that he personally thought Harrison Ford would make an ideal Indiana Jones. He had even described him in one treatment as being played by someone like Harrison Ford. But Lucas had used Ford in every movie he'd directed or produced since American Graffiti, and didn't want to be seen as relying on a stable of actors, in the same way Scorsese repeatedly utilized actor Robert De Niro or Coppola had used James Caan. Still, Lucas and Spielberg met with Ford anyway and immediately knew they'd found their Dr. Jones. Ford's contract was signed in June 1980, only a few weeks before principal filming was scheduled to begin in France. There were some inside Paramount who were still skeptical of Spielberg's ability to bring in a film on time and on budget. And Spielberg, despite the success of Jaws and Close Encounters, was coming off the bomb 1941. For Spielberg then, Raiders was a film to clean out my system, as he described it later, to blow the saliva out of my mouthpiece. Lucas advised Spielberg to approach the film almost as if he were directing an old movie serial. Shooting, said Lucas, quick and dirty. In a clever bit of misdirection, Lucas also advised Paramount that the film would be shot in 88 days, while he and Spielberg had privately agreed it could probably be finished more quickly than that. This way, if Paramount asked, Lucas could always tell the studio they were ahead of schedule and would be left alone. Lucas had also supplied Spielberg with a first-rate supporting staff, utilizing much of the same crew at Elstree that Lucas had used on The Empire Strikes Back, installing Howard Kazanjian as an executive producer, and putting ILM entirely at his disposal for special effects. Spielberg would be permitted to hire an associate producer of his choice as well, bringing in Frank Marshall, a veteran of several films for Peter Bogdanovich. "What I learned on Raiders is that you set the whole thing up," said Lucas. "Get the script pretty much the way you want it. Then, if you hire the right person whom you agree with, you go with their vision. But the truth is, we agreed completely on the vision. Or almost." Lucas and Spielberg still disagreed over the nature of Indy's character. Lucas saw him as a slick playboy who used treasure hunting to support a posh lifestyle, all traits that Spielberg, who saw Indy as more noble than that, tried to downplay. And ultimately, as he had done with Han Solo, Harrison Ford managed to incorporate a bit of his own personality into the character, giving Indy just the right combination of vitality and vulnerability. Filming began on June 23, 1980, and for the most part, Lucas left Spielberg alone, one of the few directors he wouldn't hover over or pick at. "You're the director," he would tell Spielberg. "This is your movie." Spielberg, who saw himself as mostly a hired gun, was having none of it. "Wait a minute, you're the producer," Spielberg would shoot back. "This is your movie." For the most part, Lucas was content mainly to solve problems and keep an eye on the bottom line. When the cost of building a four-engine flying wing threatened to send production over budget, for example, Lucas simply broke two engines off the concept model and told the crew to build it that way. The plane came in under budget. There were still times, however, when he found himself itching to look through the camera, and with Spielberg's indulgence, he would direct a second unit crew. It's great to see George running around with his director's hat on, chasing a second unit around, setting up shots and shooting them, said Spielberg. At one point, Kasdan asked Lucas why he hadn't directed Raiders himself. Because then I'd never get to see it, Lucas responded matter-of-factly. At the moment, however, he was actually subject to a technicality that would have prevented him from directing, or at least receiving a director's credit, even if he'd wanted to. On the theatrical release of Empire, Lucas had placed all the film's credits at the end of the movie, just as he had done with Star Wars, which meant director Irvin Kershner didn't receive his director's credit at the beginning of the movie, as mandated by the writers and directors' guilds. While the guilds had looked the other way on Star Wars, the Lucasfilm logo they decided counted as the director's and writer's name, this time they threatened to have the film pulled from theaters unless Lucas recut the movie with the credits at the beginning, and fined director Irvin Kershner $25,000 for Lucas's defiance. To Lucas, it was a preposterous requirement. Why bore an audience with credits when you could jump right into the action? He refused to recut, paid Kershner's penalty himself, I consider it extortion, Lucas seethed, then resigned from both guilds. The credits would stay at the end, where most films have put them ever since, and Lucas would remain as disdainful of guilds and unions as ever. George and Marcia trailed along after Spielberg as he moved from Elstree to Tunisia, where Spielberg filmed in many of the same locations Lucas had used in Star Wars, and finally to Hawaii, where the opening moments of the movie would be shot during the final week of production. Spielberg completed filming on the 73rd day, right on the schedule he and Lucas had privately concocted, but 15 days ahead of the one they'd submitted to Paramount. They celebrated Marcia's birthday at the wrap party, where Lucas dared producer Frank Marshall to jump into her birthday cake. He did. While principal photography had been completed quickly, Lucas was disappointed to find ILM was lagging behind, struggling mostly with the effects needed for the sequence with the opening of the Ark. ILM had been given free rein. The only direction provided in the script was, "They open the box and all hell breaks loose." But everyone, from Lucas on down to the last animator, was unhappy with the sequence. With 6 months to finish the scene, the suggestion was made to hand off the effects to an outside company. Lucas was out of patience. "I'd done Star Wars, for God's sakes," he exploded. "I knew what real worry was." ILM would finish the effects on time and in spectacular fashion, but they would do so with Lucas practically straddling their shoulders. Lucas had promised Spielberg final cut, but that didn't mean he wasn't going to involve himself in the editing process. Spielberg had insisted on using his own editor, Michael Kahn, whom he'd worked with on Close Encounters, and Lucas sat with Kahn to review the first pass on the movie. Spielberg wasn't concerned about what Lucas might do. "I get to change it all back if I don't like what George is doing to the picture," he said. "But I have never not liked what George has done." As it turned out, Lucas asked for very few changes, for example, the removal of a joke that he thought fell flat. But there was one sequence, in which Indy shoots a scimitar-spinning swordsman dead rather than face a prolonged fight, which Lucas was still uncertain of. Spielberg had filmed the scene both with and without the fight, and Lucas actually preferred the longer version. But Spielberg, exercising the power of Final Cut, insisted on the shortened version, and Lucas, when he saw the reaction from a test audience, had to agree. "Well, I guess that works," he admitted to Spielberg. There was one last editorial opinion that mattered. After watching the final cut, Marcia Lucas pointed out that the audience hadn't seen what happened to Marion after she and Indy survived the ordeal with the Ark. There was a collective slapping of foreheads, and Harrison Ford and Karen Allen returned to film a brief scene on the steps of San Francisco City Hall, in which Marion and Indy walk away arm in arm in what Allen called their Casablanca moment. George might have intuitively known when a film didn't work logically, but Marcia could always tell when he'd shortchanged the audience emotionally. As 1980 drew to a close, The Empire Strikes Back and Raiders of the Lost Ark weren't the only projects Lucas had had his hands on over the past year. In November, Lucas donated nearly $5 million to the University of Southern California to underwrite the costs of constructing a 15,000-square-foot post-production facility with state-of-the-art equipment for what else? Editing, sound recording, and animation, three of Lucas's passions. It's logical and appropriate for me to support the place that provided me with the means to get going into film, Lucas said. A year later, Marsha would participate in the groundbreaking ceremony, and the $14 million project would be completed by November 1984. Gone were the rickety buildings and worn-looking central patio. In their place were the George Lucas Instructional Building, the Steven Spielberg Music Scoring Stage, the Marsha Lucas Post-Production Building, and the Gary Kurtz Patio. Another project had come at the request of Coppola, who asked Lucas to help one of their idols, 70-year-old director Akira Kurosawa, find the funding he needed to complete his samurai drama Kagemusha, which had been left in the lurch by Japan's Toho Studios. It was a tragedy, said Lucas. It was like telling Michelangelo, all right, you're 70, and we're not letting you paint anymore. With the heft of Star Wars behind him, Lucas went to Ladd, who secured funding from Fox just as he was being hustled out the door. On its release in 1980, Kagemusha went on to win the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, vindication for the venerable filmmaker as well as for Lucas, who saw it as practically a moral obligation to assist fellow filmmakers in need, either young directors who haven't had a shot at it, Lucas said, or older directors who've been passed by but still have creative ideas. As for a young director who hadn't yet had a shot, in 1980, that was Lucas's scribe of choice, Lawrence Kasdan, who was looking to direct one of his own screenplays, the steamy thriller Body Heat. Ladd was interested in producing it at his own production outfit, the Ladd Company, but informed Kasdan, in a move reminiscent of Lucas's experience on American Graffiti, that he had to find a name producer who could step in if the film ran into trouble. Lucas thought the idea of Kasdan needing an overseer was ridiculous, but he threw the weight of his name behind the project anyway, and assured Ladd that he would be happy to defer his fee to cover the cost of any overages. Publicly, however, Lucas maintained a low profile, keeping his name off the credits. There would have been a giant controversy about me making this picture, he sighed, and making sure all the credit for the film's success went to Kasdan. Body Heat opened to strong reviews in 1981 and turned a healthy profit. Lucas's faith in Kasdan to pull it off had never wavered. Kasdan would go on to write and direct hits like The Big Chill and Silverado, and would come back to write both Return of the Jedi and, more than 30 years later, The Force Awakens. Less successfully, Lucas had also helped find funding for a project by another old friend, John Cordy, who perhaps more than anybody else had inspired American Zoetrope with his Northern California beachfront film studio, had been experimenting with a new kind of animation he called Lumage, in which an image was cut out and then lit from below the animation stand instead of above. Lucas, always intrigued by animation, arranged for Cordy to meet with Ladd, who agreed to finance Cordy's Twice Upon a Time for the Ladd Company. The film would open in 1982 and quietly sink out of sight. Nobody knew quite how to sell it, sighed Cordy. Lucas, however, would have no problem selling another movie he already had in pre-production in 1980. On May 14th, 1 week before the premiere of The Empire Strikes Back, Lucas had announced at a press conference that he already had a title for his next film, Revenge of the Jedi. George Lucas was finally done with Hollywood. While work on The Empire Strikes Back had required Lucas to maintain offices in Southern California with that film wrapped, and before production could kick in on Jedi, Lucas closed down the Egg Company and brought everything north. The move would take several months, and Lucas couldn't get away fast enough. Hollywood is like a grandiose high school as far as I'm concerned, he said derisively. And to his disappointment, employees at the Egg Company hadn't behaved much better. It was a bunch of spoiled people, said Lucasfilm Chief of Operations, Robert Grieber. Assistant Bunny Alsop lamented that our delightful casual Lucasfilm was fading into a big deal corporation. Lucas also clashed with his own hand-picked president, Charlie Weber. George was focused on building the ranch, making Jedi, creating this kind of filmmakers community, said one Lucasfilm insider. While Charlie was looking at diversifying into other businesses to invest George's money. But George had no interest in diversifying. Lucas dismissed Weber and promoted Grieber. The Egg Company was gone. Lucasfilm would now reside entirely in Northern California, much of it at the ranch once it was completed. At the moment, Lucas was concentrating mainly on building what he referred to as the Farm Group, a small cluster of buildings that would eventually house the ranch manager and caretaker, with the main ranch house further up a curving road beyond a man-made lake. Lucas wanted everything to be interesting and well-designed. The Victorian-influenced buildings would be octagonal, with casement windows and stained glass, tongue and groove paneling, cupolas, and fireplaces. Modern, with state-of-the-art equipment, yet looking as if they'd been sitting in the hills for generations. George set out to bring the vision we shared for Zoetrope into reality. The way he saw it, said Coppola, who, flush with the success of Apocalypse Now, was trying to get back in the empire-building business himself. Looking for a new headquarters for Zoetrope, he was angling to purchase a property he couldn't afford at Hollywood General Studios. Lucas has a bank called Star Wars, said Spielberg coyly. Coppola doesn't have a bank, only courage and fortitude. The courageous Coppola approached Lucas and Spielberg for funding and was turned down by both. Coppola was irked, but Lucas was even madder at what he saw as Coppola's colossal gall at trying to one-up him. Francis helped me and gave me a chance, but at the same time, he made a lot of money off me, Lucas said later. Francis has a tendency to see the parade marching down the street and to run in front of it with a flag and become the leader. What annoyed Lucas more than anything else was the very idea that Coppola would abandon Northern California in favor of the pestilence of Hollywood. I thought Francis was betraying all of us in San Francisco who had been struggling to make this community a viable film alternative. Coppola would raise the money and head south anyway, and true to form, he would lose the studio 3 years later, hard on the heels of his musical flop, One from the Heart. That was typical Coppola and typical Lucas. Sitting together for an interview years later, both were asked what they would do if suddenly given $2 billion to do anything they wished. Where Coppola replied with his usual bombast, I'd borrow another $2 billion and build a city. Lucas's response was straight out of Modesto. I'd invest $1 billion of it, he said, and use the other billion to build a town. With Skywalker Ranch, that's exactly what he was doing. No detail was too small for Lucas to obsess over. Visitors to Park House would find one room filled with fabric swatches, blueprints, and furniture samples, as if Lucas wanted everyone to understand just how seriously he was taking this ranch endeavor. Within a year, he would proudly be walking the property with a reporter from the New York Times, showing off the nearly completed main house, swimming pool, and tennis courts. The 3-acre lake, which Lucas would later dub Lake Ewok, would be stocked with trout, while an electronic deer fence lined the perimeter, much to the annoyance of the neighbors. Beneath their feet, a series of tunnels connected the buildings, and closed-circuit television cameras swept the complex, looking for invaders or the merely nosy. It's a totally controlled environment, Lucas said proudly. Totally controlled, just the way he liked it. With the company's shift north, the other major task was to ensure that ILM, still working out of the Kerner building, stayed in business permanently. Up until now, as one ILM model maker described it, a kind of lifestyle had been established where everybody worked on one film and, when it was done, everything came to an end. Lucas wanted that to change. While Weber had boasted that ILM could become a first-class entity by continuing to create effects for Lucas-produced films, Lucas wasn't actually involved with enough films at any given moment to keep ILM open full-time. Instead, he let it be known that ILM could be hired to produce effects for anyone. We were trying to bring in outside projects so that we can keep everyone here working, said Lucas. The first non-Lucas project to come through the door would be the Paramount Disney film Dragonslayer, though even it had a touch of family about it, as it was written, produced, and directed by two members of the USC Mafia, Hal Barwood and Matthew Robbins. Over the next 3 years, ILM would take on a dozen more projects on its way to becoming the preeminent special effects shop. Over a 15-year period from 1980 to 1995, ILM would win the Academy Award for Best Visual Effects 13 times, often competing with itself in the same category. There was one particular special effect that would turn out to have far-reaching impact, though the film in which it appeared, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, wouldn't even be in contention for the Academy Award. The remarkable sequence, a computer-generated flyover of the creation of a planet with volcanoes bursting and clouds forming, was actually the result of frustration on the part of Ed Catmull, who had spent the previous 2 years trying to convince Lucas that his computer division could do more than just build digital editing and mixing equipment. Determined to prove the point, Catmull and his team put together the computer-animated footage that would become Star Trek II's Genesis effect sequence. Catmull called it a 60-second commercial to George Lucas, to prove they could create realistic animation with the computer, and hoped for the best. It was groundbreaking work, the first fully computer-animated sequence to appear in any film, and wowed everyone but Lucas, who watched from a doorway, congratulated the team on one of the camera shots, then disappeared. Still, Lucas was pragmatic enough to appreciate it as the kind of work ILM needed. When Mark Hamill, understandably protective of the Star Wars franchise, heard that the computer division was doing a computer animation for the rival Star Trek franchise, he whirled on Lucas in mock protest. "You traitors!" Hamill roared. "George, how could you do that?" "It's business, kid," said Lucas.